Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Serving spiritual seekers around the world. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I am your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. It's kind of muggy here, waiting on thunderstorms, but can't complain. We need the water, so it's a good thing. Today I welcome back to the show Phil Goldberg. Phil is an interfaith minister. He's a counselor and blogger, as well as a prolific author. His bestsellers include The Intuitive Edge, Road Signs on the Spiritual Path, and the best-selling, award-winning American Veda, The History of Hinduism in America, How Indian Spirituality Changed the West. A meditator and a meditation teacher for many, many years, and lecturer, Phil also leads groups to India, and today he'll join me to share about his knowledge of the spirituality of the Beatles, among other topics. So it's a joy to welcome Philip Goldberg back to the show. Welcome, Phil.
Hi, Paul. Good to be with you. And you didn't mention that I'm the host of the podcast Spirit Matters, where you were a recent guest, and people can listen to that as well.
How remiss of me, but that is absolutely true, and I enjoyed it thoroughly, being on the show with Dennis Raimondi and Phil Goldberg last week, and I did put it up on my Facebook, and if you'd like to, on my website, so if you'd like to listen to it, tune in. It was an honor to be on that particular show, because I know you interview some luminaries, don't you?
And yes, so we do.
Yeah,
we
was do. Very honored to be included in that show.
And so it's my great honor to be here today.
Well, good. Excellent. Thank you. We're glad you are. Before we jump into the Beatles and the spirituality of the 60s and 70s and all, and the sea change that made in American culture, let's talk a little bit about your recent visit to India, because I know you just got back recently, right? What were some of the standouts this time?
Well, I led a tour. It was the first American Veda tour. We were in the north. And we were in wonderful places. We got up into the Himalayas a bit, and we were in Delhi and Agra and Vrindavan, which is a site of Krishna worship. And we were in Rishikesh and Calcutta and environs, and, of course, Varanasi, the holy city that used to be called Benares. And, of course, one of the highlights, to segue perhaps, was the ashram where the Beatles famously went in 1968 on a sojourn that was world-changing. And it's the ashram had gone to ruins a bit, but they're fixing it up now as a place to accommodate interested tourists. And we visited there and reminisced a bit. But the tour itself was wonderful, and we visited a lot of holy places, met a lot of swamis and gurus and interesting people, and altogether a wonderful 3 weeks.
You know, it surprises me that that particular ashram is, fell into ruin because, the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was such an influential figure, and I guess he built other places. Is there any particular reason why he relinquished that particular ashram?
What happened was, I mean, the history is after the Beatles were there, it was the place where he would train teachers. Are we okay?
Yes.
Okay, I heard strange sounds. I'm sorry. He would use that ashram, his meditation academy, to train teachers. And the Beatles were actually there during one of those teacher training courses. And when his transcendental meditation became a global phenomenon after the Beatles were there, the ashram was too small to train the number of teachers who wanted to be trained, so he started training teachers in the West. And the ashram was used only for Indian teachers for a number of years. And then it had been a long-term lease, so at one point in the 90s, the lease expired, and the government decided to not renew it and let it go back into its natural state. It's right up against the jungle in the Himalayan foothills, and they wanted, by way of wildlife preservation, to let the jungle grow back in. But then there was a change of mind last year, and they decided to fix it up and restore some of the property, and put up signage and all that, and open it up for people to come and as a kind of landmark, historical landmark.
You famously, of course, it's the site of number of Beatles songs, isn't it? There are a lot of songs there, and one of the more famous ones is Dear Prudence, and I know you've got a connection to the actual Prudence that inspired that song.
During the time the Beatles were there, they were there to meditate a lot and to listen to discourses and discussions, but there was time to write and play music. And they had a creative burst that really made not just spiritual history, but musical history. Because most of the songs on the famous White Album and some of the songs on Abbey Road were written while they were there. And one of them, as you said, was Dear Prudence. And, the story behind that is the participants in the course, there were, maybe 150 or so people, maybe 200, were at one point they were told to meditate for long periods. And Prudence Farrow, her name was at the time, now Prudence Farrow Bruns, was Mia Farrow's sister, and both Prudence and Mia were there. And Prudence was really a dedicated spiritual aspirant and meditator and yogi, and got a bit carried away and was meditating for such long periods of time she didn't come out of her room, and people were a little concerned about that. And so John Lennon wrote Dear Prudence, and actually never got to play it for her because they left before she told me. I knew Prudence a few years after that, and our paths have crossed many times. And she told me that she didn't just tell me, but she has a memoir called Dear Prudence, which I highly recommend. And in it, she says that she didn't even know they had written it or hadn't heard the song or known what the lyrics were until it was actually available on the White Album. But, Dear Prudence, come out to, won't you come out to play, was written because she was holed up in her room meditating all day.
Right. Fascinating. You know, I devoured music when I was a teenager, of all kinds, you know, from rock music to classical. But I remember listening to the White Album when I was about 16 or 17 and just being totally transfixed, you know, because I think there's so much sonic variety on that album. It's a tour de force, isn't it, of different styles from ballads to, you know, to craziness to, you know, quite spiritual lyrics and just the delightful, you know, it was a time when each Beatle was sort of experimenting individually. So it didn't seem to be a joint effort as much as just everybody was enjoying their own creativity. And it showed in that double album. And, that amongst many of the songs on there, you know, are ones that have become, you know, standards, if you like, of excellence. And delightful album, I think.
And some of them, what's interesting is, you know, I give these presentations like I'm going to be doing at Unity of Fort Worth soon about the Beatles and their spiritual journey, often with live music. And so one of the things I talk about is how after they took up meditation and got on their spiritual path, they, and especially George, wrote songs that were explicitly about spirituality and their meditation experience and so forth, and drawing from the especially in George's case, drawing from the teachings of what we think of as the Hindu tradition or the Vedic tradition, all the yogic ideals and so forth. But many of the songs, if not almost all the songs they wrote while in India, had nothing to do with that. They were just songs that were percolating up in their imaginations or were based on things they saw and people they met while they were there at the academy in Rishikesh, like Prudence and like the song Get Back was written for a guy who was there, and they just named him Jojo in the song, but his real name was Terry. And so there were a lot of examples of just creativity taking many different forms.
Right, you're right, isn't it? It's true that, you know, George is the one that imbibed it completely and became a practitioner of that brand of spirituality. You know, the other Beatles may have been influenced, but they certainly didn't show it so much in their writing. But I think that's right. Okay, isn't it? It's like a case in point of how spirituality can influence you. Some people take it very literally and become, you know, yogis like George Harrison did. Others take that's it right. and it influences their mindset to a degree, like John Lennon. But, you know, John Lennon was too much of a iconoclast, I think, to ever follow a certain line. And in others that are more secular, more worldly, like Paul McCartney and Ringo, you know, took the essence of it, of love, but they didn't really take on board anything else.
And they took the practice seriously. You know, when all four of them learned to meditate, and then they went off to India a few months later. It was, if you look at the history of it, like I have, you know, in American Veda and subsequently in my talks and things, you see that, you know, the most enthusiastic of the four were George and John originally. And
right.
they were all over the media advocating TM and meditation and Indian philosophy and essentially being spokespersons for Maharishi back in, you know, the late 1967 and early 68. I mean, you can go on online and hear, you know, wonderful interview with David Frost with George and John back, you know, about meditation, which was a very new thing in the mind of most people in those days. I mean, concepts like meditating every day and and using a mantra or having a guru, or, you know, those are revolutionary concepts back in the time. And the most outspoken were George and John. And Paul and Ringo seemed to be going along for the ride, and they actually left India much before John and George did. But it turns out they took to the practice itself and used it somewhat consistently over the years. And now, of course, they're the only two still alive. But they've done benefits. David Lynch, the filmmaker, has a foundation where he brings meditation to disadvantaged groups and veterans and people like that. And John and, Paul and Ringo have done benefits for it, because the practice of meditation itself still was a valued part of their lives, even though they didn't become the dedicated yogis and practitioners that George became.
In terms of, Hinduism in the West, of course, we can trace it back, as you do in your American Veda book, you know, to luminaries like Emerson, you know, was very interested in Hindu thought and Eastern mm-hmm. thought in general. And then the influx of, or the beginnings of the influx of Hindus themselves into the States, you know, like Vivekananda, you know, the World's Parliament mm-hmm. of Religions, etc. And then, of course, the biggest one of all, I guess, would be, you know, Paramahansa Yogananda, right? Back in the 20s up to the 50s. And you were in featured in a movie recently, weren't you, called, I think, Wake, right? Mm-hmm. About the life of Yogananda. And I learned some things, because I'd read the autobiography of a yogi, which is probably one of the most seminal books that, you know, people read when you're on the spiritual path. It seems to be one of those books that's so influential. For me, it was influential because I love the way Yogananda combined Hinduism with the Bible and Jesus. You know, that mm-hmm, there were so mm-hmm. many quotes from scripture, from Christian scripture in it. And I could really get my head around that, you know, because I love the synthesis of those two traditions, you know, because there's an essential mystical core, isn't there? So what about the Beat Generation? I know a lot of them turned more to Buddhism than Hinduism, right?
Yeah, but just if I may complete your thought about Yogananda, there were many, many gurus and swamis and yoga masters who have come here and had big followings and had a big influence. We mentioned three of them so far, and the three, I think, who had the biggest public profiles. One was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, especially in the 60s and 70s. And the other was Vivekananda, who was the first of the gurus to come in the 1890s. And in between was Yogananda, who was the first to live in America, make America his home. So he was here from 1920 until his passing in 1952, except for 2 years when he went back to India. He had an enormous impact, and one of the reasons for that impact is that incredible autobiography of the yogi, which to this day is one of the primary doorways into Eastern spirituality for many, many people. And yes, you mentioned the documentary Awake, which I highly recommend, and I don't recommend it just because I'm in it. I'm only a small, you know, part of it, a talking head for a few minutes, but it's a really wonderful documentary about his life. And I will say, by way of advanced publicity, that the book I'm currently working on is a biography of Yogananda, and I hope that'll be available to your listeners in a couple of years.
That's going to be fascinating. You know, one thing I learned from the movie, and I'm sure you'll go into it in your book, is I didn't realize there was scandal associated with Yogananda, as there are with, you know, there is with many of the gurus, but they really tried to do a hatchet job on him, didn't they? But it didn't seem to work. He rebounded. But at one point he was so disheartened, he decided to leave the States for a while.
Yeah, and almost went back to India and gave up the whole thing. He had actually considered that, but the pull of his own personal karma and the mission that was given to him to bring these teachings to the West was obviously far too strong, and overcame, you know, his personal disappointment with the treatment he received by the media and so forth. And yeah, you know, a lot of gurus have had scandals. A lot of gurus deserved the bad publicity, and others were just victims of sensationalism and a rumor mongering and that sort of thing. And back in those days, in the 20s and 30s, people in America were simply not used to dark-skinned men preaching what many of them considered, you know, blasphemous and, you know, heathen, false religion and all that. And there were many enthusiastic students and followers, many of whom were women. And they, yes. You know, people were very threatened by this and didn't know what to make of it. And, you know, the image of a yogi and a or inscrutable Oriental who might hypnotize the women into doing unspeakable things. You know, this sounds crazy to us now, but it was very real thing back then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Folks, I'm with Phil Goldberg, and we're talking about the influence of Hinduism in the West, and particularly on the Beatles, and we'll talk more about that in the second segment. We're going to take a break, listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be right back. Join us then.
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727 from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
What if you could experience vibrant health, help heal the planet, and be a great friend to God's animal kingdom through simple choices you make at breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Authors Victoria and Adair Moran say you can do this easily, affordably, and deliciously in their new book, Main Street Vegan. Everything you need to know to eat healthfully and live compassionately in a real world. Loaded with practical tips, straightforward information, and fabulous recipes, Main Street Vegan will help you on your journey toward a plant-based diet. The perks include more energy, an easy way to keep your weight where you want it, feeling younger as you grow older, and maybe even a boost to your spiritual life. Purchase Main Street Vegan from BN.com, Amazon.com, or your favorite bookseller.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find. Thank you.
been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm talking with Phil Goldberg, just at the smorgasbord of ideas around Hinduism in America and the West and the Beatles and the influence of spirituality on them. We mentioned some of the precursors of this influx of Hinduism, some of the great gurus of the 20th century and their influence in the West. But I was also asking about the beats, and, you know, I'm a big enjoyer of beat writings, especially Jack Kerouac. I've always enjoyed his writings. But, of course, he was very influenced by, you know, Buddhism, wasn't he? It seems like a lot of those West Coast beats, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg, you know, Gregory Corso and others, that were influenced more by the influx of Zen coming out of Japan more than Hinduism.
Yeah, you're right. The beats were primarily associated with Buddhism and more specifically with Zen Buddhism. And both the famous teachers from Japan whose names were Suzuki, Shunryu Suzuki and D.H. Suzuki, they were closely associated with them and with the Zen Center in San Francisco. And so, yes, people like Gary Snyder, who was, you know, so much of his poetry was influenced by Zen tradition and his time spent in Japan. And similarly, Allen Ginsberg and Kerouac were very much influenced by Buddhism. And later, Ginsberg, you know, spent a lot of time with Trungpa Rinpoche, in the Tibetan Buddhist teacher who came and settled in Boulder, Colorado. But at the same time, they were also influenced by a lot of the other Eastern spiritual teachings, because the San Francisco in those years of the mid and late 50s and early 60s, when the beats were in their prime, San Francisco was a hotbed of Eastern spirituality. That's when Alan Watts started to become famous, and other teachers in that area. And so all the Eastern traditions, streams of Hinduism and streams of Buddhism, streams of Taoism were in the air, especially coming from Alan Watts. And but you're right, it was mostly a Buddhist influence on the beats, and that Zen sensibility filtered into their poetry. But the thing people don't necessarily remember is that Allen Ginsberg was also quite a bhakti yogi. He was, you know, largely responsible for the Hare Krishna movement becoming more prominent, and the guru who brought the Hare Krishna tradition to the West, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, was very close with Allen Ginsberg, and Allen would be chanting Hindu mantras, Sanskrit mantras, in the streets with the Hare Krishnas, and by himself with his harmonium at all kinds of places, at hippie gatherings and at anti-war, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, and even famously in 1968 on the on William F. Buckley's talk show. If your listeners want to go online to YouTube, you can Google Allen Ginsberg and William Buckley, and you'll see a segment where he was being interviewed by Buckley and took out his harmonium and did the Hare Krishna chant on national television. So he was a more eclectic a kind of spiritual guy, but Buddhism was the principal influence on the beats. And that sort of was a precursor to the hippie era and the Beatles, because it sort of was part of the gradual influx of Eastern traditions, and they're becoming more familiar with larger segments of the population and becoming more legitimized in people's eyes.
Of course, there's that strong influence of drugs, isn't there, in terms of this in the 60s. Yes. You know, the growing prevalence of people using marijuana and then LSD, you know, that drove people to first of all, I guess, to Mexico and some of the spiritualities there, and then to Morocco, mm-hmm. and then to India, and, you know, looking for enlightenment, but also looking for, you know, a transcendent high as well. So there's a, yeah. And of course the Beatles themselves, you know, turned on to LSD and then found Eastern philosophy, right? It kind of, yeah. they kind of went together in some way, right?
Yeah, and in that sense, they were a template for what happened to many, many thousands of people, including me and people of our generation, you know, the baby boomer seekers who, yes, as you suggest, LSD, especially all the psychoactive drugs, were a big part of this story that I tell in American Veda. And so in the mid and late 60s, when psychedelic drugs became prevalent, people were taking them for various reasons, some of it just to get high and have some kicks, but many were using them as doorways into the transcendent. And they were opening up, you know, people's minds and consciousness to experiences that were very familiar to anybody who investigated the mystical literature of all the world's traditions, as you do on your show, but were, you know, hitting people suddenly and unexpectedly with the ingestion of these drugs and opening the floodgates to exploration of consciousness. And so people like Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, you know, were, you know, left their Harvard experiments and turned to the streets. And Richard Alpert, of course, went on to India and became Ram Dass, a beloved spiritual teacher. And the Beatles had a similar trajectory. You know, they were famously taking drugs and dropping acid, and it influenced a lot of their music, especially in the sort of Sgt. Pepper era and Magical Mystery Tour. And then, you know, they got on to learning meditation from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and part of their public advocacy that I mentioned earlier was about, we don't do LSD. You know, we had our LSD phase, and now, you know, that opened the consciousness, but there are natural and safe ways to experience the divine, and so we're turning to meditation now, and their example was followed by many, many thousands of young people who said, oh, there's safer and more natural alternatives to the more dangerous path of dropping LSD. And that was a terribly, terribly important event in the spiritual history of the West, because it led not only practitioners to clean up their acts and take up practices like yoga and meditation, but it led their parents and school teachers and other authority figures who were of the older generation to take these things more seriously, because the meditation and yoga experiences were, as alternatives to drugs, you could say, were changing people's lives for the better. And that led to scientists wanting to study what was going on. And that the whole history of the last 40 years of meditation becoming mainstream was largely because of the scientific research that was done. It legitimized these practices.
Of course, many people did both, didn't they? They you know, still maintained an ingestion of certain drugs and meditated, you know, but but maybe not the more radical drugs that can give you bad trips or whatever, you know, that was
you or they the use them more judiciously in the context of a spiritual life, as opposed to just, you know, kicks on the weekend or whatever.
Well, I can't remember who said it, but many people have said it. Maybe it was Ram Dass's guru, you know. But you know, once you've opened the door, you know, you don't have to keep opening the door. You just walk through.
Yeah.
And LSD can be a way to open the door, right? And then you don't need to be continually ingesting it.
Right. And I think one of the other metaphors was. When the phone rings, once you answer it, you can hang up. You don't have to keep picking up that particular phone.
Right.
Something like that. But there were many, many, you know, analogies and answers to that. I mean, Houston Smith, you know, the famous scholar of religion, who wrote the foreword to Introduction to American Veda, I'm honored to say, you know, he was very friendly with Ram Dass and Timothy Leary in those days of the Harvard experiments on LSD and the big upheaval, and was very upset by these substances becoming casual usage, you know, having casual usage in the counterculture and the people having bad trips. And, you know, there were dangers afoot. And he famously said there's a big difference between altered states of consciousness and altered traits of behavior, and a big difference between having a mystical experience and having a real spiritual life. And the practices that we imbibed from the East were able to give people a really legitimate and authentic spiritual life with methods that were very efficacious, whereas you know, the haphazard nature of taking drugs and the dangers of it was a very different situation.
Well, on the dark side, you know, which was the apotheosis of that was with Charles Manson, I guess, and the, you know, the slayings that he perpetrated, and then his reference of a Beatles song, right? Helter Skelter.
That's a Rolling Stones song. Oh no, you're right. Right. The movie was Helter Skelter, whatever. But you know, to get back to the Beatles, that phase of counterculture, psychedelic drugs, and so forth, sort of the apex of that was the Summer of Love in 1967. And George Harrison went there, you know, thinking he'd find kindred spirits and all.
Right.
But he had already spent time in India studying sitar with Ravi Shankar. And he had read Autobiography of a Yogi, and he had read Vivekananda's books, and was ready for, you know, making the spiritual life a more of a centerpiece in his own life. And he saw a lot of casualties when he went to San Francisco in that Summer of Love, and said, you know, it was apparently, from what I've read, one of the things that sort of said, well, you know, this phase of my life, you know, it's time to move on. And then, you know, he discovered meditation, and later the world of Hare Krishna chanting, and became a devotee. And so that transitional period of the, you know, psychedelic counterculture segueing into an era of yoga and meditation and mindfulness practice and all that is a bit of history that is terribly significant.
Well, he almost referred to it, didn't he, as a sort of spiritual materialism. You know, it was a form of commerce rather than a form of spirituality. You know, we're all dressed up. And I think it was John Lennon that said that, you know, what did we do in the 60s? We just dressed up. And of course, typically, you know, John Lennon, isn't it? But there's a certain truth to it, isn't there? That a lot of people just went along for the ride and wore the clothes and you know, did all the things, you know.
In truth, a lot of people, you know, had an attitude of spiritual materialism when, you know, around all the gurus who became famous in the 70s. And even now, you know, yoga is a big thing. Mindfulness is a big thing. And this is a wonderful addition to American spiritual life and spiritual culture. But, you know, there's always people who are in it because it's trendy, or because it's fashionable, or as John said, you know, to just dress up. But there's also, you know, a serious side to this and a deep spiritual aspect of it that's not to be denied.
Of course. And in fact, they nest together, don't they? Like everything in life, you know, we can't have the beautiful flowers without the earthquakes, right? So everything is blended together. We can't make it a picturesque universe just so everything's cozy and nice and safe. And you know, I felt the same way when I went to India, you know, in the mid-70s and spent a year there. You know, in the same way that you did, you know, exploring that spirituality and finding many people who, you know, were strung out and not doing so well, or others that were exploiting people. But then in the midst of that, there was the joy of, you know, discovering this unitive teaching. And I think that's the essence that a lot of us have brought from it is, you know, the idea that this is a mystical truth that it's within Zen Buddhism, it's within Tibetan, but certainly within Hinduism and Sufism as well, for those who you know, open to that path, Taoism, you know, all these paths, to me, you know, because I'm a hopeless romantic, maybe they all point to the same mystical truth, you know, which is the unitive essence of everything, right?
I couldn't agree more, as you know,
right.
And it was, you know, people like Aldous Huxley and Houston Smith and Joseph Campbell who brought those insights, the insights into the commonality at the core essence of all the world's spiritual traditions to the awareness of larger numbers of people. And all of them were influenced by the Eastern traditions. Because that insight was maintained in the East and preserved somehow, whereas in the West we got caught up in focusing on differences among religious traditions and on what as Houston Smith would call the exoteric, the external, more superficial aspects of religious life, like doctrine and dogma and ritual, and competing views of history and truth claims, whereas the esoteric aspect, the inner experiences, and that the mystical teachings and the methodologies like meditation and yoga and so forth open up to us, that's where you find the unity. And so you'll find that experience of non-dual oneness at the core of all the world's traditions, if you look deeply enough. And I mean, that's the crux of the matter to me is like the ancient teachings of the Rig Veda and the Hindu tradition tell us, you know, if you go deeply enough through any path, you will ultimately come to the one essential essence and truth of the universe, which is, of course, within us.
Right.
Within you, without you, as George wrote.
Another great song. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Well, it is true, isn't it? Almost without exception, that although there is a great, you know, Christian mystical tradition, it kind of went through a hard time there since the Enlightenment, since Cartesian thinking, you know, empiricism, whatever, that led to the wonderful technological advancements of the industrial and post-industrial age, but also impoverished us. And you know, it sort of lingered in poetry, I guess, in the Romantic poets and in writers like Emerson and Thoreau. You know, they maintained it, but we don't get a huge depth of mystical tradition in Christianity since, you know, some of the great mystics of the Middle Ages. So we have, I think, without exception, had a find renewal from the East. Even people like Thomas Merton, you know, Catholic mystics, heavily influenced by Eastern theology and fascinated by it, you know, because it provided a way to understand things that Christianity had forgotten. You know, it'd become a very different beast back in the 19th and 20th centuries. So, we owe a great deal of honor to those Eastern traditions, you know, to bring that back to us.
Yes, and there's this incredible developments within Christianity and also Judaism in America the last decade or so, a tremendous revival of contemplative Christianity and Jewish mysticism with these ancient techniques, mystical insights and methodologies that were lost to the mainstream and have become much more accessible now, and the catalyst for that, and I try to document this in American Veda, the major catalyst for that was what we've been talking about, the sudden emergence on the scene in the 60s and 70s of meditative disciplines from what we think of as Hindu and Buddhist traditions. It awakened people to these possibilities, and leaders in the Christian and Jewish world said, don't we have stuff like that? And sure enough, if you look deeply enough, there it was in Kabbalah, in St. John of the Cross, and Teresa of Avila, and all the Christian mystics, in the cloud of unknowing, and all this was there, but it was lost and buried. So people like Merton and Thomas Keating, and now Richard Rohr, and other people like Mirabai Star are bringing out these teachings from the Christian mystical tradition and making methods of meditation and inner contemplation available to large numbers of people. And similar things are happening in the Jewish world. And right. It would not surprise me if we saw among Muslims in the West a revival of the Sufi tradition, the mystical tradition of Islam.
Well, and you're right, you know, and people like Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, you know, in that golden Sufi order have been synthesizing Sufism into the West. And you mentioned Richard Rohr, you know, who speaks almost beautiful non-dualism. It's quite amazing. And other folks who have taken basic Eastern philosophy like mantra meditation and sort of linked it with elements of Catholic tradition, you know, centering prayer,
that's
like
right.
Thomas Keating and folks like
that's
that.
Right.
That's exciting,
and
isn't it?
And let's not leave out your tradition, Paul. I mean, we're on Unity FM.
Absolutely.
Unity Church and what used to be called Science of Mind, the centers of spiritual living in that new thought tradition have sort of kept those core mystical insights alive in the principles of unity and the other new thought traditions. And of course, they too were influenced a lot by the East as well. And, so let's give credit in that department as well.
And, you know, you're absolutely right, because, you know, unity itself came out of, you know, the transcendentalism and mental healing. But, you know, I think Emerson was a huge influence on the spiritual landscape of unity, whether directly or indirectly. You know, it influenced so much of that thinking of that age, the late 19th century.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, the beginnings of unity happened. And plus the Eastern influence on Charles and Myrtle Fillmore as well. So, yeah, fascinating.
That's right. That's right. In fact, we mentioned Swami Vivekananda and the Parliament of World's Religions. Well, they were there.
Yes.
You know, so they were in attendance at that
time. So I've got an impossible question for you now, Phil.
Well, Paul, it's been great being with you.
You know, you can't slip out of it that easily. So what's your favorite Beatles song?
Oh, God.
I said it was impossible.
You know, I'm not good at what's your favorite movie or what's your favorite song, because it changes. You know, it's different at different times. So I wouldn't say it's my favorite song in terms of what I like to listen to and what will catch my attention, because there's so many of them. But I always like to single out, as we mentioned earlier, George Harrison's Within You, Without You on the Sgt. Pepper album.
Mm-hmm.
And I single that out because I call it the first rock and roll Upanishad. If you listen to the lyrics, it's a very, you know, 1967 clear expression of George's newfound insights that he was getting from his study of the Vedic tradition. So
right.
I single that out. But in terms of listening, it really depends on my mood. To be honest, one of my favorite songs is, oh God, now I'm blanking on the name. I can't even think of it. Nowhere Man.
Ah, right.
There's something about the harmonies and of Nowhere Man. And when I was doing research for my presentations on the Beatles, I realized that it was essentially their first grown-up song. And it was deeply sensitive insight into sort of the existential crisis of modern life that mm-hmm. John had. And it's I always find it deeply moving, and the harmonies. And of course, I love Let It Be and Here Comes the Sun. And, you know, these are all songs of, you know, that elicit kind of deep inner feelings and deep emotions.
Yes.
So, ask me again tomorrow, and I'll have another list for you.
And that's fine. It was an impossible question. I think for sheer listening pleasure, you know, I think the whole of Abbey Road for me is the album that I go back to over and over again, because it's such an exuberant CD, and there's so much on it that gels very well together. Everything fits.
The last sequence on Abbey Road. That's long connected series of, you know, different lyrics and motifs at the end. It's just spectacular.
Absolutely. You know, I love, like I said, the White Album, because it's sheer creativity, but it's definitely a collection of separate pieces, whereas Abbey Road seems to be all one of a kind. And then, like you said, that final sequence of 20 minutes or so where it just unfolds to that, you know, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. You know, that's a sort of a, even though it wasn't actually the last Beatles album that was written, right? It's often considered to be the last one, because I think it was put out last.
Yeah.
But it seems to be a fitting end, doesn't it, to that particular cycle of what they were doing.
I know. Mm. And when you think about it, the love you take is equal to the love you make. It's a pretty good maxim to hold on to for your life.
Right. Yeah. We live in balance, folks. And life is good, no matter how crazy it appears to be, which it often does. All right, we have about a minute left. One final thought, wisdom to take into our week, Phil. What would you suggest for people?
Turn within, find the essence of love and peace and universal consciousness within you. That seems to be the foundational truth to carry through life.
Right. Very good.
Seek ye first
the kingdom, huh?
Yes.
The inner presence. And if you want something musical, I suggest you get hold of the While My Guitar Gently Weeps version done at the Rock and Roll induction ceremony for George Harrison, because it has wonderful music up front, but then it's got a transcendent solo by Prince, which we lost
amazing.
Last week, and that is pretty amazing. So it's a wonderful song. Great honor to George, but also this amazing piece at the end there from Prince. So that's a good one, too. We're at the end of the show. Thank you, Phil, for being with us.
Thank you, Paul.
And if you're in Fort Worth, come on this weekend. Phil's going to be here. He's going to do a wonderful multimedia presentation on Saturday at our church and do a workshop and speak on Sundays. So it's going to be a wonderful weekend for us. But right now, thank you for being with us, and thanks for listening. And we have a mystery guest next week, so I'm not going to tell you who it is. So it'll keep you guessing. All right. Join us then. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
God is formless, yet takes many forms. What goes around comes around. Chant the name of the Lord and be free. No one comes to the Father except through me. Ever been confused by the variety and apparent contradiction within world religions? Join Reverend Paul John Roach every Tuesday for insight into those principles held in common by all the great religious traditions in world spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions. Using discussions, interviews, humor, insight, and practical advice, we will clarify the confusion and reveal simple yet profound truths. Call in with your questions and ideas and help break down the barriers that separate us from one another. That's World Spirituality with Paul John Roach, Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, here on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world.
Too often, people desire prosperity but are not willing to pay the price. What is the price? It is sharing, giving, loving, and caring. Prosperity needs an inflow and an outflow, just as a body of water does if it is to remain fresh and clean. As we create an outflow by giving in love, we experience the inflow of a greater awareness of good in our lives. Perhaps you've been led to believe that for every winner in this game we call life, there must be a loser. The truth is that you rarely lose by giving. In giving freely without thought of return, we set in motion a great momentum of goodness. When we give, everyone is a winner. You have something unique to offer the world, something no one else can give. Whatever your gift, know that it is precious, give it freely, share it in love.
This message has been brought to you by the Association of Unity Churches International. To find a Unity Church near you, visit www.unity.org.
Blissful stillness, come to me. Blissful stillness, come.
tens of thousands of listeners, like you, have been transformed through the ministry of Paulette Pipe and her program, Touching the Stillness, one of the longest-running programs on Unity Online Radio. Paulette's latest album of guided meditations, Blissful Stillness, is a new and different experience. The mystical quality of her beautiful voice will reverberate through a Zen-style meditation, a mudra meditation, which are yoga hand positions to deepen your practice, and guided meditations, which we know and love. It features a new instrumental sound by Kelly Hunt with a bonus track by Kathy Zavada. Experience a blissful immersion into quiet and stillness by purchasing your own copy at shop.unityonline.org.
Blissful stillness.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.